The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good evening, everyone, and welcome to IMC. And I'd like to start this evening with recounting a conversation that was purported to have been spoken some 2,500 years ago. And it's a conversation between the Buddha's disciple, Ananda, and a man who was visiting, belonged to a different religion. And the man asked this three questions of Ananda. He asked, who is it that has a teaching that is well proclaimed? And then he asked, who is it who practices a good practice? And the third question is, who is it who has attained, who are the fortunate ones? Who are those who are fortunate? So that's what he asked. And so Ananda made this very interesting response. So the first question is about who has a well-proclaimed doctrine. And back then in ancient India, in relationship to people like Ananda, who was a monk, a renunciant, it was really talking about religious doctrines, or what we would call religious. And Ananda said that whoever teaches a doctrine for the abandonment of greed, hate, and delusion. Whoever teaches a doctrine for the abandonment of greed, hate, and delusion has a well-proclaimed dharma or teaching. And then whoever is practicing to abandon greed, hate, and delusion is practicing well. Answering the second question. Then the third question was answered by whoever has abandoned greed, hate, and delusion are the fortunate ones. So this is an interesting answer in a number of ways. Back in the ancient India, there was a debate culture between people of different religions. And so it wasn't so innocent for someone to come and ask the Buddha a question like this. It could easily be that he was prepared to be in debate with him. And he was testing him and finding out, what do you think the best teaching is? What do you think the best practice is? And what do you think the best attainment is? And one of the things that makes Buddha's answer interesting was in highlighting possibility of the end or the abandonment of greed, hate, and delusion, he was offering a response which had no, which wasn't really a doctrine. It wasn't a set of religious principles. It wasn't a reference to the supernatural world, rebirth and some kind of, ultimate cosmic truth or something, reality. It wasn't some existential truth about the nature of humanity or the nature of the universe we're in. It wasn't anything that we would normally consider to be religious doctrine. And now in the modern West, perhaps, when someone talks about, overcoming greed, hate, and delusion, it probably kind of would fit closer into a psychology than into a religion. If you want to get the IRS non-profit status for being a religion, And you have to kind of explain your religious beliefs a little bit to the IRS to get approved. And you say, well, we believe in the abandonment of greed, hate, and delusion. And I would like to be a religion. I think people would like, what? And so the Ananda is coming back with a response that doesn't have it doesn't engage or doesn't set up a possibility for conflict or debate about spiritual and religious ideas or about what's ultimately true. The other thing he did is that I think back in the ancient world, maybe, and I hope in our world too, our world as well, that I think it's generally considered a good thing not to have greed. It's generally considered a good thing not to have hate. And it's generally considered a good thing not to have delusion. So this was something that most people could agree on. This is really good. And so he was offering something that was easily understood, easily kind of valued, and that across the board. So when he gave this response to the man said, fantastic. I go for refuge now to the Buddha Dharma Sangha. He thought this was a good enough answer that he now became kind of a Buddhist. So clearly he thought that greed, hate, and delusion was a very wonderful goal. Now, when I was 13, it was around that age, I started to somehow become conscious enough of the ideas of what was going on in this world that I was wondering about this notion of God. I was raised basically an atheist. I was an atheist. But, you know, the God thing was around our society, so I was beginning to, you know, remember there used to be Mormons who would come knocking at the door. And then I would stand there in the door and we'd have these discussions, debates, maybe, about God. So I was thinking about God and all that. So my idea was that, and I thought as a 13-year-old, was that if there was a God, or if there is a God, I guess God isn't something that was. Was, is, and will be. If there is a God, the primary thing that God would like to see is for people to be ethical, to live an ethical life. And beyond that, I couldn't imagine a God who cared whether you believed in him or her or not, as long as you were ethical. It just like didn't compute. Like why? If you're living an ethical and good life, then shouldn't that be enough? So it didn't really matter if you believed in God, I decided. What mattered was if you're ethical. Now maybe that kind of, as a 13-year-old, maybe that idea came a little bit out of the kind of cultural background that I had. I was born into a Norwegian culture, which is very individualistic, a particular kind of individualism. Maybe it's a kind of a socialist individualism or individualistic socialism or something. So, but anyway, the idea of kind of being an individual and just like being yourself and being ethical is enough. Maybe it was kind of came from that culture. So Ananda presented this kind of almost like ethical ideal, the abandonment of greed, hate, and delusion. And why I call it ethical also is because this is the primary, what these three things are called the primary roots in Buddhism, the roots of all unethical behavior. So if you're involved in unethical behavior, one or all three of these roots have to be operating. There has to be greed, there has to be hate, and there has to be delusion. And you find in these Buddhist texts and Buddhist teachers like myself will sometimes kind of rattle off this greed, hate, and delusion so freely, refer to it over and over and over again, that I imagine that if you hear it or read about it so much, it kind of just kind of you kind of gloss over it. But what I wanted to say today is that in the ancient teachings of the Buddha, these are really a fundamental category, fundamental teaching. And the idea of greed, hate, and delusion, they're umbrella terms that encompass a whole family of mental states that under each of those categories. So greed is not just greed, it's also lust, it's craving, it's attachment, it's longing, it's the whole... There's a list in one ancient text that goes on over some, like, I don't know how many, 30, 40 synonyms, close synonyms for this. So they're kind of very wide encompassing, a wide range of things, mental states. The Buddha said repeatedly, he defined repeatedly the goal that he has for his teaching, for where his teachings are pointing to, is the destruction of greed, hate, and delusion. And so to really make this point strong, that this is really important, there's a series of 44 discourses, like these ancient texts have all these, series of short little discourses all together. They organize them and gather them together. And there's 44 of them in a row where the Buddha, these discourses are pretty much the same, but the main point is to offer a whole series of synonyms for the destruction of greed, hate, and delusion. And this is things like greed, hate, and delusion is the the destruction. Excuse me. The destruction of greed, hate, and delusion is the unconditioned. The destruction of greed, hate, and delusion is the truth. The destruction of greed, hate, and delusion is nirvana. The destruction of greed, hate, and delusion is the deathless. The destruction of greed, hate, and delusion is the ageless. The destruction of, one of my favorite one, is the destruction of greed, hate, and delusion is the amazing. And so all these kind of, wonderful, ultimate kind of labels. So on one hand, what you find in the ancient world, the Buddha was reluctant to offer ultimate teachings, or this is ultimately true, but he did talk about a goal where ultimately or fully greed, hate, and delusion was eradicated, was uprooted. They're the roots in us, and we have to uproot them. And the reason why they're called roots, they're because they're like a plant that some plants, if you just simply chop off the top above the ground, they'll resprout. And so all the manifestations, all the behavior that comes out of greed, hate, and delusion, you might stop the behavior. You might stop certain attitudes and certain kind of things that come from greed, hate, and delusion. But if the roots are still there, the greed, hate, and delusion will continue to pop up. Now, the reason, the Buddha talked a lot about this greed, hate, and delusion thing. One of the things he said is that greed, hate, and delusion are a vexation. Greed, hate, and delusion are harmful. They're injurious. Greed, hate, and delusion injures the person who has greed, hate, and delusion. And that's a little bit hard for people to see who have these things, especially because there's something about greed, hate, and delusion which camouflages itself for the person who has it. Now, with greed, for example, we generally want something, and so we focus on the object of what we want. If we have hatred or ill will, it's usually about something that we have ill will about. And there can be a lot of energy behind the desire and a lot of energy behind what we don't like. And so we're focusing on the thing, as opposed to being attentive to what it feels like in us to have those states. But if we're able to feel strong desire and turn our attention around 180 degrees and look at ourselves and feel ourselves, we'll feel that greed is a fever, a vexation, a burden, a form of injury, a harm. These are all words that the Buddha used. Hatred the same way, that hatred is uncomfortable, it's a vexation, it's a suffering, it's painful, it's harmful, it's an injury, it's a burden. Same with delusion. So there's something about inherent in these qualities. So they're called ethical, but it's not so much, not only it's ethical partly because it's injurious, but it injures the person who has it. So if you have a splinter, if you have a thorn in your foot, it's the most natural thing in the world to want to pull it out, to take it out. You don't need to have, you know, you have a thorn and you don't have to go and on the internet, you know, and you know, fine, you know, I'm not going to do anything about this thorn. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to leave it there until I get 32 reasons for why it needs to come out. You know, you just you bend down and pull it out. So, so the idea is that in the same way, if you can feel the effect that greed, hate, and delusion has on you, wanting to eradicate it, to pull it out, is as easily, the motivation for it is as easy as having this the thorn in your foot. In other words, we don't need to have religious teachings, you don't need to go to IMC, you don't need to go, you know, read the teachings of the Buddha, you don't need anyone to tell you to stop doing something that you feel is, you feel or you see is injuring yourself. And this is and so then Buddha, when he gave examples of what you could know for yourself, he talked about greed, hate, and delusion, and the abandonment of greed, hate, and delusion. There's a wonderful text, sutta, where the Buddha talks about this, where these people come to the Buddha and they say, a lot of religious people, different teachers and stuff, different religions, come through town. And they all have different doctrines and teachings. And they're all saying, we have the truth and all that. And so they go to the Buddha and say, now, can you tell us whose teachings are true and whose are false? So the Buddha does an interesting move, in which he does repeatedly in his teaching. He doesn't engage people on the question of what is religiously true and false. So they ask him, can you tell us what is true and false? And he says, so he doesn't answer them directly. He changes the, he's a politician kind of like, right? He changes the, religious politician. He changes the conversation to in a different direction. He says, he understands, he says, yes, it's right. It is confusing, perplexing to have all these different people come around and make all these different claims. Do not rely on tradition. Do not rely on scripture. Do not rely on your teachers. Do not rely on this person just because the person's your guru. Do not rely on your logic. Do not rely on your, you know, intuition, kind of. And you mentioned a few others. Now, these sources of authority are kind of like pretty foundational for a lot of different religious beliefs. They come from these sources. And so he says, don't rely on them. What's left? And what he said was, you should rely on your own experience. But not in your own experience. If you rely on your own experience too naively, we end up relying on our opinions, on our preferences, on our interpretations of things. But so what part of our direct experience did the Buddha emphasize? He said, the way he most pointed to is when you can feel, to use my language, a thorn in your foot. when you can feel in yourself something hurts or that something doesn't hurt. If you recognize you're being harmed or you recognize you're being benefited. When you recognize something hurts, and when you recognize something brings happiness or brings suffering. And then he uses as an example of what you can know that is causes harm and what you know causes the opposite. He goes through the three unethical roots, greed, hate, and delusion. This you can know for yourself. So if you want to rely on your... he changes from the question. First he says, he doesn't answer the question about is it true or false. He tells people what not to rely on. And then rather than engage in discussion of what's true and false, religious ideas and doctrine, he's more interested in action. The Buddha was more interested in what people do than what they believe. And what he was interested in what they do is they learn to abandon the things that they do that cause us harm and learn to engage in those things which are beneficial. And his assumption is you can know this for yourself by paying careful attention to yourself, by really knowing here. And this is where the function of one of the key functions of mindfulness. The function of mindfulness is not just to kind of just, calm down and have less stress in your life, stress reduction, is to create the conditions, enough calm, enough clear attention, to be able to feel the thornness, the agitation, the vexation of these different movements of our mind that we have. And I think it's fair to say there's plenty of people who have greed, hate, and delusion who don't feel how painful it is to have these things. But if they did, that would be motivating for them to abandon them, to stop having them. For the Buddha also, greed, hate, and delusion is the foundation, the root, not only for all ethical behavior, but the root for all suffering. And this is where it gets really interesting in terms of the message of the Buddha or what he's pointing to, is that he's pointing to the total ending of what he calls suffering. The total ending of suffering and replacing it with something much better. And there's two words that he uses to just talk about what's better. He talks about peace, and he talks about happiness. Those are the two kind of the positive mental states or qualities that, are the opposite for him. And so a transformation. So an absence of greed, hate, and delusion that brings peace and happiness. Now some people might say that the abandonment of greed, hate, and delusion, these ethical psychological qualities, is rather a modest goal for, in the world of religion, because religions have, wonderful, cosmic, transcendental, ultimate, teachings and goals and all kinds of things that are very, very important. And but what's brilliant about the Buddha, I think, coming and talking about greed, hate, and delusion, is that most people agree that this is important. So if some people think that, these Buddhists, they have this minor goal, it's kind of a low-grade religious goal, We'll put up with the Buddhists, they're kind of like... yes, but we agree that greed, hate, and delusion is important. But, there's more. There's more greater goals. Well, that's fine. There's no problem with that. But don't ignore letting go of your greed, your hate, and delusion. Don't put up with it so you can go on to this greater goal. Most religions agree, yes, do these things. The ethical teachings of most religions are very important. I think what Buddhism contributes to maybe other religions is the encouragement to take those part of the teaching seriously. And then if you really want to do this thoroughly, this eradication of greed, hate, and delusion, it really helps to do something like mindfulness, some deep kind of introspection that goes on, so we can really see and feel and know what's going on. And the advantage of doing this kind of deep introspection is that you become your own teacher. You begin to discover what the Dharma is. And in fact, there's a wonderful statement the Buddha said, that if you want to know what the Dharma really is, the Dharma that's visible here and now, that's immediately available, then what you should know is you should know greed, hate, and delusion, and the experience of having the absence of greed, hate, and delusion. If you can see those two things in yourself, having known greed, hate, and delusion, and knowing that it's disappeared, it's gone, then you have a first-hand direct encounter, experience, you know for yourself what the Buddha was teaching. So it's not like that sophisticated. It's not like some, you know, it's not like rocket science spirituality. And it's a relatively simple teaching. But it's so powerful because these things, greed, hate, and delusion, as the roots, are so intimately tied, so intimately connected to so many of the ways in which people live stressful lives, painful lives, so many ways in which people injure themselves, but also so much part of how they injure other people. So much of the harm that we see in the world comes from originates in people's greed and their hatred and their delusion. So Buddhism, at least in the teachings of the Buddha, keeps over and over again putting up a mirror saying, look at this, look at this, look at this. And so if you hear teachings from Buddhist teachers, or if you read Buddhist texts, and they keep kind of over and over again using the language of greed, hate, and delusion, don't blank out because you hear it so many times. There they go again, you know, and like, you know, da da da. But these are really central and important and pivotal and key foundational aspects of the Buddha, teachings of the Buddha. And if you think that it's a lesser goal, you know, if you want something a little more sophisticated, you'll be surprised as the greed, hate, and delusion disappear, that you're living in a much more richer, fascinating, I don't know if sophisticated is the right word, but even better than sophisticated. The knowledge, the understanding, the peace, the qualities of compassion and care, and the things that get born, that arise when the mind is not agitated from greed, hate, and delusion. It's not caught, it's not preoccupied. It's phenomenal. It's one of the great things. And so in Buddhism, it's considered to be the ultimate possibility. So then I'll end with one quote from the Buddha. He said, if it were not possible to eradicate greed, hate, and delusion, I would not instruct you to do so. But it is possible to uproot greed, hate, and delusion. Therefore, I instruct you to do so. It is possible. That's the good news. So that's what I had to say for today. So we have about 10 minutes. If any of you would like to ask any questions about this or anything else, you're welcome. So is there a...
You're talking about ethics, and then it sounds like the Buddha feels you should look and see. You know? You're talking about ethics, and it sounded like you're saying the Buddha says you should look at yourself and see about greed, hate, and delusion. When I think about ethics, or if I, like if a particular situation, I feel like, hey, I'm not at ease with that. There's something feels off. It usually feels like there's several different things going on at the same time, like somebody else could make a case for it is okay. You know what I mean? In this room, there was something about 2 weeks ago where I thought the teacher gave an example of something another teacher had done, and I thought, no, it's not right. And the teacher giving the talk felt it was okay, it was good, but I didn't think so. So is the point not to find out what's perfect, because we had different ideas. It was a guest teacher. We had different ideas about what's ethical, but is it the investigation into being ethical that's important? Do you understand?
I think that, there's a number of things that are, I think, there's, you know, this is what someone else says. So I think that there's two major areas to explore, perhaps. Mm-hmm. One is in yourself. Mm-hmm. What gets triggered in you? Mm-hmm. So is there strong attachment mm-hmm. to something mm-hmm. that's excessive, the attachment? So mm-hmm. attachment is a form of greed. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of things people get attached to their opinions, to their ideas, what should be, what shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. And so has something like that been triggered?
Yeah.
Is there ill will? Is there hostility? Is there some kind of aversion to what's been said?
Mm-hmm.
And so is that live in you?
Mm-hmm.
Or is there delusion?
Mm-hmm.
Now that's the hard one to find out, you know, if I'm deluded.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's possible to kind of discover that and find that out.
Mm-hmm.
So to do a self-check,
mm-hmm.
and that's a really important thing to do.
Uh-huh.
Because why be motivated, why act in this kind of situation based on those motivations? It probably causes more harm than good,
uh-huh.
and probably has no purpose, really.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, how do we evaluate what the person said? It didn't feel right, it didn't feel harmonious with how I see the world, it seemed somehow wrong. And so you can then try to evaluate that to the best of your ability.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you evaluate that? Do you evaluate against your preferences, your opinions, or do you have certain criteria for evaluating that, what goes on?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, you know, I'm sitting here talking about the Buddha,
uh-huh.
and he offered a series of evaluations, the criteria for looking at our ethical behavior.
Mm-hmm.
He tended to be a consequentialist. He was very uh-huh. interested in the consequences of things.
Uh-huh.
So listening to what the opinion was,
mm-hmm.
What are the consequences of that kind of opinion? Is this a consequence that's going to be supportive? Is it not going to be supportive? Is it useful in certain times, but not in other times, as opposed to a general statement?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, is this going to be harmful to people mm-hmm. to hear this mm-hmm. or not?
Mm-hmm.
And if you think that it's going to be harmful, what they say, mm-hmm. if it seems appropriate, you can talk to the person and say
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm.
It helps to speak only after you've done your self-check.
I see.
So that you're kind of clear and clean in how you speak, if there's time for that, and you know, that. Yeah. Because the Buddha did talk about he did praise people who lived by the precepts
mm-hmm.
and encouraged others to live by the precepts.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't just a message about just take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Encouraging others to be ethical is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then, so we want to evaluate it. We want to evaluate what people have said. And so what criteria do you use to evaluate that?
Uh-huh.
And if you have clear criteria, then you're in a better position to have a conversation with a person.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we have unarticulated opinions and view. It just seems wrong.
Yeah.
And then it's not so productive to have a conversation.
Uh-huh.
But if you have a clear articulated reasons for why you feel you believe what you believe,
uh-huh.
that might help the other person to be able to articulate their, you know, the basis of their views.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I'm going on. Is this helpful, or am I to the point?
Yeah, it's helpful. Thank you.
I think learning to think ethically
mm-hmm.
is a useful thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's particularly true for We live in a much more complicated, interconnected society than the Buddha did.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're asked to vote. We have professional ethics. We have all kinds of ways in which we're asked to or expected to participate in the public sphere of life that wasn't the case 2,500 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't a question should there or shouldn't be death penalty. Mm-hmm. It was just the king said off with the head.
Yeah.
And if you said stop, you shouldn't do that, and had a little protest in front of the palace, and off with your head.
Yeah.
You know, but now we can vote for these things. And so how do we engage? How do we involve in ethical decisions that are not directly connected to ourselves, our own action in the moment?
Mm-hmm.
And so this requires a kind of ethical thinking, mm-hmm. and be able to think in a clear, consistent way about the public good. And mm-hmm. that becomes much more complicated than the kind of ethics that traditionally, historically, has been emphasized in Buddhism, which is like my talk today, mm-hmm. which was very personal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So, I work with a lot of people who have a lot of thorns in their feet. Who have a lot of thorns in their feet.
Oh, yeah.
And it seems when I talk to them that they're very aware of the thorns in their feet. But then when I try and give them certain advice about how to become more aware of those thorns or do something to change those thorns, I often just see them say, like, yeah, well, okay, and then they just keep kind of stomping around and digging the thorns in deeper. So I guess, like, what advice would you give to people who seem to be aware of the thorns but have a lot of trouble taking action, creating some sort of a habit to actually affect change in themselves?
Yeah, if in simple and appropriate ways you've tried to support them or help them and they're not receptive to it, I think then probably the best thing you can do is to love them. Be kind to them, be supportive, be present in a friendly, good way. I think that it's great medicine for people to receive that and feel that, and to feel, and when they're with you, that they feel safe, they feel comfortable, and appreciate the warmth that you have. That lets something deeper kind of settle in people, maybe, that can't settle if you're kind of like always, you should be taking your thorns out. And then it might take a little bit, it might seem like a little counterintuitive or slower, but then maybe it creates the conditions in a year from now to have a different kind of conversation because they've learned to trust you or feel safe around you. And if they don't have that conversation, it's still good for them.
I'd like to go back to greed, hatred, and delusion. And delusion in particular, because greed and hatred seem easier to identify, but there's a little, it's a conundrum to say how can one know when one is deluded. And there's the catechism that tells us that delusion is not seeing the impermanence and unsatisfactoriness and the non-self nature of things. But I'm wondering if that's a little too pat, if there's something more to the notion of delusion than just those three characteristics. And second, how about the way in which greed, hatred, and delusion are interrelated? Would it be possible to eliminate greed and hatred without touching delusion, for example?
Mm. Nice. So for the second question, I hope you can come back and tell us sometime. I'd like to know. I think... But the first one, delusion is hard to see, but I think this is where strong mindfulness helps a lot, because maybe it won't show all delusion, but if you have strong mindfulness and the mind is quiet, steady enough in order to really see clearly, you can watch the birth of a thought. And if you can really be there and watch a thought appear, chances are you'll recognize a lot of delusion. Because you say, oh, that's just a thought. Usually thoughts are in control and they're going along a mile a minute and we're just barely keeping up with them and they're telling us what's the truth. And, you know, which kind of, this is how it is. And so, you know, the example I've used often is that if you're walking down the street and you see a person, and we can have all kinds of judgments about people so quickly. And the seeing and the judgment are so integrated, happen together, that we don't really see any difference between the judgment and the person. There's like, all, it's all this, you know, together. But if you can watch the thought be born, then you have a chance to see that the person and the thought are two different things. And then you can evaluate the thought. You say, wait a minute. So you see someone, and that person you see is someone maybe, is a kind of person that you tend to be afraid of. And it reminds you of a bully that you had as a child. But it's not the bully, it's just someone who has the same physique, right? And so you can see the person, you know, you recognize that they're seeing, and then you see the thought arise, uh-oh. But it's just a thought. And you say, well, you know, that's a thought. Let me take another look. Oh, that's not the bully. That was a kind of a delusion. That was the assumption that my history is, you know, they're giving me about who that person is. And then, because of taking the moment to take a second look and to see, and you see the recognition of the bias, the thought, the judgment as that, and you see how it's different than the experience that you're looking at. And that in so many different ways, if you can be there as a thought arises, a lot of our thoughts are not worth having. A lot of our thoughts are, you know, not quite right. They're kind of delusion. And one of the ones, in terms of those three characteristics you talk about, it's possible to actually watch in the mind the production of the idea that this is permanent. This is always going to be this way. And it's because sometimes it's more like a feeling. I'm kind of like in awe of this feeling that I still can have somehow. I know so much better. I know that things aren't permanent. But my stomach doesn't know that, or something inside doesn't know that. You know, like, uh-oh, it's like the feeling inside, oh, this is going to be forever. You know, and then I tell myself, Gil, you know it's not that. But some of the emotional responses we have come along with a kind of message. And it's possible to see that message is not quite right. It's kind of diluted. So this idea, oh, this is forever feeling, is, you know, you say, oh, you know, I know better, it's, you know, I've had this feeling before, and many times, and it doesn't last.
Thank you, that's really helpful.
Great. So one of the things I really like about this teaching about greed, hate, and delusion, it's clearly, among other things, it's an ethical teaching. And it's, in the way the Buddha talks about it, it's clearly an ethical teaching in relationship to oneself and in relationship to others. But the way it's presented, there's no sharp line between the personal world and the interpersonal world. I think it's fair to say that in many places in our modern Western society, we've ended up in a kind of cultural mindset where there's a very sharp line for many people between the personal and the public, the personal and the interpersonal. And our personal lives and what goes on inside of us is like so paramount and so big and all that. What it seems to be a case in the 2,500 years ago in a very different culture and times of ancient Indian Buddhism, it seems that they didn't have that very sharp divide between the personal and interpersonal. So that when people are taking care of the personal, of eradicating greed, hate, and delusion, it was not seen as being separate from taking care of the society and the world around us, because these weren't so sharply divided as we have. So sometimes when we read through the modern lens of modern, modern eyes, these ancient texts, sometimes they seem like they're too personal, and there's not enough emphasis on the interpersonal world. But if you read carefully, you see that these are completely, what's the right word? Completely interrelated in a very deep way. So interrelated that it doesn't occur to people back then to separate these two worlds. So, thank you.